From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, sitting in for Terry Gross, who's visiting member station WUWM in Milwaukee today. Just about a year ago, Terry spoke with writer Wallace Stegner, and many of us heard in him a certain grace and wisdom that made the interview a favorite here. Stegner died last night from injuries he received in a car accident. On today's Fresh Air, we rebroadcast the interview in which Stegner talked about living and writing in the West. Also, writer Ernest Gaines tells us about growing up on a Louisiana plantation and what drew him to Steinbeck and Chekhov. Gaines is the author of The Autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman. His new novel, A Lesson Before Dying, is his first in 10 years. That and more coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. At a meeting of the major industrial nations in Tokyo today, the United States proposed giving more aid to Russia. NPR's Marjorie Sun has more.
The United States made the proposal at a meeting of ministers from the world's major industrialized nations. The ministers are here to hammer out a new emergency package of aid to help Russia. U.S. officials proposed that G7 members give $4 billion to help convert Russia's large state-owned industries into private companies. They said the U.S. would be willing to contribute $500 million of this new aid if other G7 members and international financial institutions are willing to put up the rest. Earlier in the day, the Japanese government announced a new aid package of $1.8 billion to Russia, most of which is in the form of trade insurance. Until recently, Japan has refused to give substantial aid to Moscow because of a long-standing territorial dispute. But under pressure from other G7 members, Japan has decided to give more aid, although the dispute still has not been resolved. I'm Marjorie Sun in Tokyo.
Russia's ambassador to the United Nations has asked the Security Council to call an urgent meeting next month on the Yugoslav crisis and other UN peacekeeping efforts. Diplomats at the UN said that Ambassador Yuli Vorontsov made the request to the other four permanent members of the Council. Russian diplomats have succeeded in stalling key votes on UN action in the former Yugoslavia, primarily because Russian President Boris Yeltsin faces a key referendum later this month. The Russian public generally supports the Serbs, and it's feared that UN action against the Serbs would hurt Yeltsin's chances in the referendum. Following talks in Egypt, President Hosni Mubarak and Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin have expressed optimism that Middle East peace talks will resume as scheduled next week in Washington. However, as we hear in this report from Lori Neff in Cairo, little reason was given for their shared optimism.
While the leaders say they're hopeful peace talks will resume on April 20th, President Mubarak says Arab parties won't announce their intentions until they meet later this week.
This will be declared after the meeting of the ministers of foreign affairs in Damascus on coming Friday.
There was speculation the meeting might produce more Israeli concessions to lure Palestinians to the bargaining table, but Mubarak says the focus of their talks was the resumption of negotiations and that further concessions will have to come up during Arab-Israeli talks. Rabin did say he's already accepted in principle having a Palestinian-like Jerusalem resident Faisal Husseini on the Palestinian delegation, but he ruled out any official statement until the Palestinians officially accepted Husseini's participation. For National Public Radio, I'm Lori Neff in Cairo.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 11 points today to close at 3,455.64. This is NPR News. Millions of black workers in South Africa went on strike today during memorial services and marches for Communist Party leader Chris Hani. Most of the memorials were reported to be calm, but there were also clashes with police. At least six people were reported killed and several hundred suffered minor wounds. The worst fighting occurred in the black township of Soweto, outside Johannesburg. Witnesses charged that police fired on a relatively peaceful crowd that was already dispersing. Milwaukee's widespread outbreak of intestinal illness caused by a parasite in the city's tap water is believed to have caused several more deaths. Beth Graham of member station WUWM reports.
Three area residents with AIDS are believed to be the latest victims of the acute diarrhea caused by the organism Cryptosporidium. Milwaukee AIDS Project Director Doug Nelson says each of the three who died since last Friday were hospitalized with severe dehydration caused by diarrhea and vomiting. Cryptosporidium is also believed to have caused the death of a cancer patient a week ago. In a client survey done by the AIDS Project, 48% said they had suffered from the gastrointestinal illness sometime during the past 3 weeks. Residents in Milwaukee and 10 of its suburbs have been boiling their tap water for just over a week now. City officials hinted yesterday the boil advisory could be lifted as early as this afternoon. For National Public Radio, I'm Beth Graham in Milwaukee.
The standoff at the Branch Davidian compound near Waco, Texas, entered its 46th day today, with little indication that it will end anytime soon. An attorney for sect leader David Koresh said that his client is writing an interpretation of the seven seals from the biblical book of Revelations, but has promised to surrender as soon as he's finished. FBI negotiators had expressed the hope that the religious sect might surrender this week. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane. Writer Wallace Stegner died last night of injuries suffered in a traffic accident. He was 84. Today, we'll remember Stegner with an interview Terry Gross did with him a year ago. Wallace Stegner was known as the Dean of Western Writers. He didn't write about the Western myth. Rather, he wrote about the landscape and how it's been changed by development. And he wrote about the people who settled the West and the generations that followed. But as one critic wrote, Stegner's main region is the human spirit, how one achieves a sense of identity, permanence, a sense of home in a place where rootlessness and discontinuity dominate. Stegner was born in 1909 and grew up in a family that moved from place to place across the West. He won the Pulitzer Prize for his 1971 novel, Angle of Repose. One of his most popular books was 1943's semi-autobiographical Big Rock Candy Mountain. And he held an important place in American literature as a teacher as well as a writer. For 26 years, he headed the creative writing program at Stanford University. Here's a reading from the introduction of his 1992 book of essays, Where the Bluebird Sings to the Lemonade Springs, in which Stegner wrote about the true believers and the wishful thinkers who settled the West, people like his father.
I know that historical hope, energy, carelessness, and self-deception. I knew it before I could talk. My father practically invented it, though he qualified more as sucker than as booster, and profited accordingly. He was a boomer from the age of 14, always on the lookout for the big chance, the ground floor, the inside track. As a youth, he tried the Wisconsin and Minnesota woods, but found only the migratory wage slavery that's always been one payoff of the American dream. He tried professional baseball, but wasn't quite good enough. In the 1890s, he floated out to North Dakota on the tail end of the land rush, but found himself in the midst of a 10-year drought and ended up speculating in wheat futures and running a blind pig. If you believe that the world owes you not merely a living but a bonanza, then restrictive laws are only an irritation and a challenge. When it became clear that Dakota's promises were indistinguishable from Siberian exile, my father dragged us out the migration route to the Northwest. His goal then was Alaska, but again he was late. The Klondike rush was long over. The survivors had straggled back. For a while, he ran a lunchroom in the Washington woods where the Seattle suburb of Redmond now is. The loggers cut down the trees and left the lunchroom among the stumps. By 1914, we were up in Saskatchewan, part of another land rush, where for a change we would be in on the ground floor and make a killing growing wheat to feed Europe's armies.
Do you think of your father's personality as being typical of a certain kind of restless loser who populated the West?
Not always a loser, you know. He was characteristic, I think, but sometimes they were losers and sometimes they were big winners. He was a product of his times, and though I used to resent him a great deal, I find that now I feel rather sorry for him. I think he was made by his times. At the end of a frontier, when there was no longer the kind of frontier opportunity that for so long had been part of the American consciousness. And he tried a lot of things and none of them worked, or very few of them worked.
So did you really resent it when you were young and every time he had a new scheme, you had a move?
Well, he was not that so much as he was a frustrated man, and sometimes he took out his frustration on whatever was handy. But that too, I can understand. I'm sometimes frustrated, and I take it out on some people, too.
You're right. My father wanted to make a killing and end up on Easy Street. I wanted to hunt up and rejoin the civilization I had been deprived of. Where did you go looking for it?
Oh, school and the public libraries, primarily. There was a big division between my home life, because neither of my parents was educated, even through high school, even to high school. So that there was no background of cultivation, reading, anything else. Though my mother was a reader, she didn't know what to read. She had no guide. She would have had a good deal of cultural capacity, you know, if she'd had any guidance, but she didn't. And I got mine from school and from the public libraries, where you know, I took out 7 books a week and read most of them.
Had you grown up on the myths and the folklore and the cliches of the West, you know, the cowboy stories?
Oh, sure. I grew up not only on the myth, but among cowboys. When we moved to Canada, we were in the tail end of a period of cattle raising, which had been pretty well wiped out in 1906 and 7 by a terrible winter. But in the protected edge of the hills where we lived, there were still cattle ranches. And lots of cowpunchers still working on ranches, hired men on horseback. They weren't the romantic figures that the myth made of them. They were also, as a class, I should say, very macho, somewhat callous, somewhat brutal. Nice guys in a way, but brutal. And they also had a code of hating the crybaby, hating anything unlike themselves, despising anything womanish or oversensitive.
There might have been no room there for somebody who spent a lot of time reading, like you.
Well, I don't know. I got into the cowboy business quite a lot as a boy, but by the time I moved out of it, I was a little tired of it because I had some little physical defects. My hands were always cold, for one thing, and you can't live in Saskatchewan with cold hands and like it. things like that. So that I resented sometimes the harshness of the code, though I was always trying to live up to it.
But what about reading? Where did that fit in? I mean, for the kind of brutal macho code that you're describing, that doesn't seem to fit with the boy.
Well, there wasn't any reading up there.
Yeah.
Up in Canada, you know, there was no public library. Every family there may have had 3 books. We traded them all over town. Sometimes they never came back. My father, at one point in his life, got excited about, I guess he'd seen a Shakespeare play, so he bought a set of Shakespeare from a traveling salesman. We had that. Hmm. We had a few things like that. Mostly what we read was magazines, I suppose, and later when we got onto them, Tarzan stories and things like that.
I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, but when I was young, my dreams were about being a cowgirl. I mean, I would literally dream,
yep,
you know, about riding a horse and wearing a leather outfit and, you know, the whole Western myth. I grew up watching Westerns and the movies and on TV, and I just loved them.
Yep.
And I'm wondering, like, growing up in the West and knowing actual cowboys, what effect those kinds of movies and novels had on you? You grew up before television.
Yeah, sure. I grew up a long time before television, and I was never actually very, very taken by the Western myth because I knew how far it was from the actual facts. A cowboy's life is spent punching post holes and branding and castrating and things like that, and very hard work and very low pay, and his celebrated liberty is generally the liberty to quit his bad job and go get another one just as bad. In terms of his migratoriness, his placelessness, his uprootedness, he was very often as bad off as a contemporary crop worker. And he's not a romantic figure in life, though very often real cowboys imitate their mythical counterparts and try to think themselves into that role. So I'm a little anti-cowboy. You've got the wrong coon here to to talk to.
You're listening to a 1992 interview that Terry Gross did with writer Wallace Stegner, who died last night. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with writer Wallace Stegner.
At what point in your life did the West start to become a place that was considered to be a place that had writers living there, writing about the region with a distinctive voice, as publishers from the region publishing those distinctive voices?
That came pretty late in my life. I had graduated from college, I think, at the age of 20 or 21, before I ever saw a writer. It seemed to me that writers were people who lived a long time ago and a long way off, and it never occurred to me that I could be one or should be one, even though I liked to write, and it was encouraged a little bit in school. I suppose it never occurred to me really to take seriously the notion of being a writer until I went away to graduate school in Iowa, and there I was offered the chance to write some stories for an M.A. thesis and jumped at the chance. And, you know, a couple of those were published in little magazines or so. That's the extent of that. And that was the middle of the Depression, and I couldn't stay on. There was no job outside, so I stayed on in school, but I couldn't stay on just to be a writer, so I took a Ph.D. in American Literature. And that pretty well killed the writing impulse for several years. It takes a long time to get over that. But about 2 years after that, I was back teaching in Salt Lake, and I sat down one afternoon and wrote a story in about 3 hours about Saskatchewan. And somebody, I guess the Virginia Quarterly, bought it, and then I was hooked. But that was pure accident. In Iowa, I had met a few writers, and I had certainly got a notion that writing was something that happened among contemporary living people. But it still hadn't jarred my consciousness that I could pretend to compete in that area.
So you said that the West became a place identified with writers, or writers identified with the West. Later in your life, when did you really feel that starting to happen?
Well, not for quite a while. I lived in Cambridge, Mass. For a while and taught at Harvard, and I met a lot of writers, some of whom were from the West, and I certainly had my mind opened up to possibilities. I guess I myself considered at that point that Western writing was some inferior, second-rate genre. I didn't have very many pretensions as a writer myself, though I had written a couple of novels. And when I wrote The Big Rock Candy Mountain, which was about the West, that more or less typecast me. By the time I had come out to Stanford, which was right at the end of World War II, there obviously was much more going on, and the GI students who came to Stanford showed up with a lot of talent and an enormous backed-up flood of energy and enthusiasm. That was the time when I really began to get enthusiastic about the possibilities in the West.
Mm-hmm.
And when we founded the writing program at Stanford, which is still going.
Yeah, well, I think you headed that creative writing program at Stanford for about 26 years. So, I mean, it's probably fair to say that you had a lot to do with nurturing a lot of the writers.
I hope I had some.
West.
Yeah, I hope I had some effect. I'm sure I had some little effect, not necessarily by teaching, but by example, because by then I was pretty deep in writing about the West, both as history and as fiction.
Mm-hmm.
I was writing only, you know, about what I knew and what I liked to write about, and there was nothing very deliberate about that. It just turned out that way.
You know, writing requires such patience and reworking, and it seems like as a writer you'd have to have the opposite kind of temperament that your father had, your father always looking for a bonanza to pan out and moving to the next place. How do you feel you got the temperament necessary to write, given the background that you grew up in?
Well, partly because I was pretty much in constant rebellion against my father, so anything he did, I would do the opposite. But also, I suppose, getting a Ph.D. teaches you patience. Believe me, you sit a long time just looking at books until the type begins to run and blur, and sitting at looking at blank walls and listening to blank voices. Patience is something learned to. When you have a book to write, particularly a long book, a novel, you have to go there 7 days a week, 4 hours a day, sit in that chair, and one of the earliest things you have to learn is to keep your seat in that chair, or don't vacate it very long. Just get up and walk around and come back and sit down. That's something that I think the profession itself teaches you. If you're going to stay in it, you have to learn it.
Mm-hmm. You taught at Stanford for about 26 years, the creative writing program. How do you think your teaching was different when you retired from what it was when you started?
It was tireder. There are some occasions when you're teaching a writing class, which has to be Socratic. You know, you can't tell them how to do it. You have to sort of help them find how to do it, which sometimes after a two-hour seminar would leave me feeling as if I'd carried the whole class up four flights of stairs on my back. That gets wearing. And sometimes, of course, the class doesn't meld. It just doesn't blend. It never comes together. I don't know quite what magic and chemistry is involved there, but you know, six out of seven or eight times, it would be wonderful, a really exhilarating kind of class to teach. And once, maybe two or three times during my 26 years, it was just a load.
Do you feel that you did some of your students a favor by telling them not to write?
I hardly ever had the nerve to tell somebody not to write. You're dealing with such sensibilities that any harsh criticism of something so intimate as a piece of fiction that somebody is determined to write is very hard on the soul of the person who has to receive that criticism. Sometimes it would save them a lot of trouble. To be told, no, I don't think you have a speck of talent. You have sometimes you're intelligent, straight A-plus students and so on, you still can't do it. The gift is not there. And without the gift, there's nothing much that can be learned. You can't teach people much. I have discouraged some young writers. I think they needed discouraging. But they were not the kind who were passionately devoted to their art. They were, essentially, they liked the idea of being writers, but they really didn't have that drive to write. So I could discourage them without killing them off. But some writers I would be very, very careful not to discourage entirely.
Mm-hmm.
Let them find out for themselves over a period, long, painful period of apprenticeship that didn't produce anything. That's the only way it would be psychically sound, I think, to let them tell themselves.
You live part of the year in Vermont, which is way out east. How did somebody so associated with the West as yourself end up living part of the year in the East?
Well, actually, I've lived in Vermont, had a house in Vermont longer than anywhere else in my life. We went there when I was teaching at the University of Wisconsin to visit some friends, and before we left, we reached down into our very thin Depression period person bought us an old farm, a real back farm, and put a few $100 into fixing it up and used it for a few summers. All the time we were at Harvard, we used it. And once we got out to Stanford, we missed a couple of years, and then we began going back because we like it. In many ways, Vermont reminds me of the West before the West began to be clear-cut and despoiled, because Vermont heals. You can clear-cut a Vermont wood, and for a while it'll just come up to Christmas trees and brush and fireweed and so on, but you turn your back for a few years and it's a young forest, and you turn your back for 15 years and you've got a woods again. That's not true in the West. The West doesn't heal in the same way. So I like Vermont because it is, though it's greener than any country I was brought up in, it is healthy. It smells the right way.
You wrote a few years ago, "Except when I have to tie my shoelaces, I don't feel 80 years old. But if I don't feel decrepit, neither do I feel wise or confident." Does that still describe how you feel?
Yeah, I'm afraid it does, because, partly I think we are a little less optimistic as the effects of age begin to catch up with us. But also, perhaps this is an absolutely cultural, predictable response. Everything looks better from the time we were young. Everything in the past looks better than the present. But I can't see much to cheer about in the present. It seems to me politics are dirtier. In terms of the West, the spoliation of the air, water, and soil, and grass, and trees is worse. We're getting closer and closer to using up what we were given, and there's nothing being replaced.
You wrote that with age you neither feel wise nor confident. Have you been waiting for wisdom, and have you always believed that wisdom comes with age and you can count on that?
There was a time when I thought I was wise, but I don't think so anymore. I think we are all more confident of ourselves in our youth, because confidence goes with physical competence and energy and the rest of it. I am not that confident anymore, and I'm not so sure that I was ever wise, you know. The things that happen, you get somehow bent by circumstances. And I used to be a real prig about my father. I really hated him, you know, for the things that he had done and for his general attitude. The longer I go, the more I feel sorry for him. And that's almost a sadder business than disliking him.
We know you wrote that he died penniless and friendless in a flea bag hotel. Were you his friend when he died?
We were still in correspondence. Yeah, I was trying to help him a little. I couldn't very much because that was in the Depression still. But he gambled on too many gold mines and so on. And the word I used was sucker, which is unkind, but that's really what he was. He believed in these things that would happen, these good things that would happen. It never occurred to him that if they were going to happen, somebody much better healed and better informed than he would already have taken advantage of him.
Writer Wallace Stegner speaking with Terry Gross. Stegner died last night after being involved in a car crash March 28th in Santa Fe, New Mexico. I'm Marty Moscowane, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscowen with Fresh Air. Ernest Gaines says he became a writer because he wanted to write what he couldn't find in the library, stories about African Americans. Coming up, we talk with the author of the autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman about growing up on a plantation in the South and about his new novel, A Lesson Before Dying. It's his first in 10 years. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Marriage of Cadmus and Harmony, a new retelling of Greek mythology by Roberto Colasso. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. UN diplomats Cyrus Vance and David Owens say that the international community should consider using military force in order to gain acceptance by Serbian factions of a peace plan for Bosnia. The call reflects the growing frustration of the two men as diplomatic options dwindle. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports from the UN.
Until now, the Vance-Owen team had rejected the use of military action to gain acceptance of their plan. While they had never ruled it out, they felt it would interfere in the ongoing peace talks. But these negotiations have stalled following the Bosnian Serbs' rejection of the Vance-Owen peace plan. Spokesman Fred Eckhart.
They feel that it could be legitimate under certain circumstances to use force to bring about the acceptance of that plan and, if necessary, its implementation after it has been accepted.
Neither Vance nor Owen have spelled out what kind of military pressure they envision. Whether or not their proposal will be accepted is another matter. So far, the international community has shown virtually no interest in any form of military involvement in the Balkan crisis. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
In Los Angeles, jury deliberations in the trial of four L.A. police officers accused of beating Rodney King recessed for the day early when one juror became ill. Judge John Davies asked both sides to agree to allow the juror to see a family doctor accompanied by a federal marshal, and this was done. The case has been in the hands of the jury for 5 days now. At issue is whether King's civil rights were violated during his videotaped arrest 2 years ago. In Moscow, trial opened today for 12 former Soviet officials accused of treason in connection with a failed 1991 coup in the former Soviet Union. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
The first day of the long-awaited trial was taken up with procedural matters, but that did give some insight into how the accused intend to defend themselves. Defense attorneys argue that the Russian Supreme Court has no jurisdiction in the case because the alleged crimes occurred in a state that no longer exists, the Soviet Union. After a lengthy recess, the three-judge panel hearing the case ruled against the defense, saying the Russian court does have jurisdiction because the alleged crimes occurred on Russian territory. The defense then challenged the objectivity of the judges and called on the prosecutors to remove themselves. Among those on trial for high treason are the former Soviet vice president, prime minister, defense minister, and the ex-head of the KGB. More than 100 witnesses are expected to testify, among them former Soviet president Mikhail Gorbachev. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 11.5 points to end at 3,455.64 on volume of 256 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a small margin. This is NPR News. Both Israeli and Egyptian leaders are saying that they have high hopes for U.S.-sponsored Middle Eastern peace talks that are slated to resume next week in Washington. Israeli Prime Minister Rabin and Egyptian President Mubarak met for more than 3 hours today to talk about the stalled negotiations. So far, only Israel has agreed to attend the talks next week. Meetings stalled on Israel's expulsion of some 400 Palestinians to southern Lebanon late last year. But the Egyptian president says that his hopes are based on the fact that all factions want peace. In Ohio, the governor has called out the National Guard to help prevent more rioting at the Southern Ohio Correctional Facility. Lorna Jordan of member station WVXU reports.
Eight guards are being held hostage at a Lucasville, Ohio prison after a riot broke out Sunday involving 450 rebel prisoners. Earlier today, the inmates renewed a death threat against at least one hostage. Inmates hung a banner out the window of the prison, threatening to take the life of one hostage guard if their demands weren't met. But prison spokeswoman Tessa Unwin downplayed the incident. She says this is part of a pattern.
The demands, when you see them, they will be self-serving and petty, as they always are in these situations. I'm not trying to say you can't know the demands. What I'm saying is that our negotiators are dealing with the situation.
According to the Portsmouth Daily Times, the demands include the hiring of more black guards and better jobs for black inmates. For National Public Radio, I'm Lorna Jordan reporting.
According to White House officials, a value-added tax is now under consideration as one way to help pay for the president's health care plan. A value-added tax is similar to a national sales tax and is now used in most industrial nations. A spokesman says while this is one plan under consideration, it's one of many, and no final decision has been made. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Ernest Gaines moved from Louisiana when he was 15, but when you read his novels, you can see he never completely left his childhood home. His stories, which include the autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman and A Gathering of Old Men, takes place in and around a southern Cajun town he calls Bayonne. It's a setting not unlike the town where Gaines grew up. Although he has lived in California since the late 40s, he returns to his home state every year as a writer in residence at the University of Southwestern Louisiana. A Lesson Before Dying is Ernest Gaines' first novel in 10 years. It's about a young black man named Jefferson who is facing execution for shooting a white liquor store owner. It's also about his relationship with a black teacher who befriends him. The book opens with the murder and the trial. This is the closing argument which Jefferson's white defense attorney makes to the jury. Ernest Gaines reads.
Gentlemen of the jury, look at him. Look at him. Look at this. Do you see a man sitting here? Do you see a man sitting here? I ask you, I implore, look carefully. Do you see a man sitting here? Look at the shape of this skull, this face as flat as the palm of my hand. Look deeply into those eyes. Do you see a modicum of intelligence? Do you see anyone here who could plan a murder, a robbery, can plan anything? A cornered animal to strike quickly out of fear, a trait inherited from his ancestors in the deepest jungle of black as Africa. Yes, yes, that he can do. But to plan, gentlemen of the jury. No, gentlemen, this skull here holds no plans. What you see here is a thing that acts on command, a thing to hold the handle of a plow, a thing to load your bales of cotton, a thing to dig your ditches, to chop your wood, to pull your corn. That is what you see here, but you do not see anything capable of planning a robbery or a murder. He does not even know the size of his clothes or his shoes. Ask him to name the months of the year. Ask him, does Christmas come before or after the 4th of July? Mention the names of Keats, of Byron, of Scott, and see whether the eyes will show one moment of recognition. Ask him to describe a rose, to quote one passage from the Constitution or the Bill of Rights. Gentlemen of the jury, this man planned a robbery? Oh, pardon me. Pardon me. I surely did not mean to insult your intelligence by saying man. Would you please forgive me for committing such an error?
The story that you've written is set in the 1940s in Louisiana.
Right.
Did you feel like you were writing history, or did you feel like you were really writing about present-day racial conditions?
No. I set the story in the 40s because I went to use that little school, such as the one that I use here in the book, and such as the one that I attended as a child. And I also wanted to use a period of time when blacks could only get a job as school teaching. Professional blacks could only get jobs as school teaching in the South, and I want to use that kind of time because you know the protagonist here, the narrator here, wants to escape the South. So I had to use the period when. Period of that time. Another thing I want to use that particular period for was at that time in the state of Louisiana, executions took place in the parish in which the crime was committed. and you had this this traveling electric chair. And, of course, you don't have that today. You have, you know, it's quite different today.
Now, you grew up on River Lake Plantation, mm-hmm. and this is in Louisiana.
Yes.
How long had your family worked this plantation?
We've been there about five generations, and I think my brother's children and would be the sixth generation. So we've been there, since just after the Civil War, I suppose.
So what, as a child, what did the plantation look like?
Well, there were you had a road, which we call the quarter, and you had houses, about 15 houses on either side of the road, built in the time of slavery, but had been improved to, they lifted up off the ground on blocks, and there were kitchen added and windows added. And you had about 15 houses on either side. You had a big house at the front facing the river, and those were the, and then you had a church, which was the school during the about 5.5 months out of the year, or 6 months out of the year, was our school, and church on Sundays for the for our parents, our ancestors. Then you had the fields surrounding all of this.
How many acres?
Bordering all the. Oh, I have no idea the acreage. You had many acres of sugar cane, cotton, corn. Whatever, potatoes, onions, all kinds of things like that. And then you had the swamps, maybe 2 or 3 miles farther away from the fields. You had the swamps, and of course, we young kids, we went into the swamps. We went to the field very early. I went into the field when I was about 8 years old to pick cotton. And I was in the swamps when I was about 12 years old, and pulling the end of a saw in the swamps. So I got to know the plantation system very well.
So did you work a full day at the age of 8?
Oh, yeah, sure. You went into the fields when the people went in the morning. You came out in the evening, and there was no such thing as 8 hours. You went in early in the morning, and you came out late in the afternoon.
When you were 8 and you were and you worked the fields, how much could you make in a day?
Oh, about 50 cents.
Was that considered a lot?
Well, I suppose it was. I suppose, you know, everything is relative, as
sure.
I said. You know, a lot of people were not making much more than that. I doubted that the adults were making more than maybe a dollar and a half or whatever amount of money they were making. I don't know exactly how much they were making at that time.
I read that your mother was 16 when you were born, and you're the oldest of 12 children.
Yes, I'm the oldest of 12, right.
She went back to work and worked the fields when you were just about a week old. Who took care of you?
My aunt did. I was raised by my aunt, Miss Augustine Jefferson, and she was crippled all of her life. She crawled over the floor as a child would have to do, as a 6-month-old child would crawl. But she did everything in the world for me and for my brothers and sister. You know, cooking the food, or washing the clothes, or patching the clothes, and even disciplining us. When we need discipline, you had to break your own switch at that time, you know, and bring it to her, and you had to, sort of kneel down and take your punishment because she could not, go after you. So we did that. She also liked to put our hand into the earth. She, we had a little a garden beside the house, a vegetable garden beside the house, and she would. In the afternoon, after it got a little cool and the sun would begin to go down behind the trees, our pecan trees, she would crawl over the floor down the steps into the garden, and she had a little short-handled hoe in which she would, work among the different vegetables, whether we had beans or sweet peas or tomatoes or cucumbers or whatever, okra, whatever we had. And she would do that.
Well, I want to talk some more, but we have to just take a very short break. And I'm speaking today on Fresh Air with Ernest Gaines. And he's written a number of books. The one I'm sure that many people have heard of, The Autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman and A Gathering of Old Men. His latest book is a novel called A Lesson Before Dying. We'll be back after a very short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with novelist Ernest Gaines. You left Louisiana for California. Your mother and your stepfather were out there and wanted you to live with them. Were you eager to go, to leave Louisiana?
I think I was. In a way, I was. And then I was I sort of hated it, too, because I was leaving my aunt and I was leaving my brothers and sister and my friends. But I knew that they wanted me to go because I could not further my education in that area where I was. There's no high school there, and we did not have any immediate kin that I could go to in the Baton Rouge or New Orleans. So I knew that, they wanted me to do it. And I always knew I wanted to, you know, get an education. I was very serious about that from a small child.
I read a story where your stepfather, I guess, was concerned about, and this is when you were in California, was concerned you were kind of hanging on the street corners, and he said, or sort of steered you toward the library. Had you ever been in a library before?
No. When I lived in Louisiana, I could not go to the library. The library was not for blacks in Louisiana. The library was for whites only in that part of Louisiana where I was. And the story about my stepfather, well, what my stepfather told me to do was to get off the block because we lived in Vallejo, California, in this small naval town. And he said, you get off the block, you're going to get into trouble because there are a lot of sailors in this town, a lot of nightclubs and women and all this sort of thing. And he said, you know, stay off the corner. So it was then, that's how I ended up in the library. And I just started, there I started reading, and I just read and read and read and I was looking for myself. I really was. I was looking for something about myself, something about my people. But this is, say, 1949, and there were no books in those libraries by and about blacks at that time. But I would just read. I would read everything
would
I put
read?
My hand on.
What would you read?
Well, at that time, I was looking for peasantry life, I would turn to anyone who wrote about peasantry life. For example, Steinbeck. I read Steinbeck, John Steinbeck, and I wrote Willa Cather. I read Willa Cather. Then I began to discover others, non-American writers, European writers, the great Russian writer Turgenev, and I didn't know how I stumbled on that, but the books were there, and Chekhov, and I began to, De Maupassant. And I began to just love literature, just love it. And still, I did not see my people. I could enjoy what they were doing because they wrote about young men and young love, and they wrote about peasant life. But they were not writing about the blacks of Louisiana, and it was then that I tried to write a book.
So you wanted to write that story, the stories that you couldn't find in the library.
That's right, yeah. I was interviewed many years later after I'd written Miss Jane Pittman by an interviewer, and he asked me, made you a writer that got you started. And I tried to think of the one book, and he said maybe it was the one that was not there and that you wanted to put there. And I said, hey, that's as good an answer as I can come up with. And I did try to write when I was about 17 years old. I tried to write a novel, and I thought it was a novel. I didn't know a thing about typing, so I wrote it out in longhand, and then I got my mother to rent me a typewriter, and I typed with one finger. And I typed on both sides of the paper. Oh, by the way, I cut the papers in half because I thought that was book size, and I thought that's what you were supposed to do. And I typed on with one finger, and I typed on single lines and all that sort of thing. I made every error that anyone can make on a piece of paper. And after about 100 pages, 150 of those pages, I wrapped it up in some paper I found in the kitchen and tied it up with some strings I found in the kitchen. Sent to New York, and of course they sent it back to me, and I burned it. We had an incinerator in the backyard, and I burned it.
And how long until the next book?
Well, I really had to get down to my studying after that, and I had to. Then I went into the Army. I came out of the Army. I enrolled at San Francisco State College to study creative writing. I spent 2 years there. Then I won a fellowship to Stanford University, and I was during that time I was writing short stories, and. An editor or agent or whatever, whoever, came from New York, I suppose, and he was saying that short stories were very hard to publish by an unknown writer. So that day I just quit. I just said, well, from now on I must write a novel. So I could not think of any other novel but the one I tried to write about 10 years before. And it took me, after I started writing, I think the next day on this novel, and it took me about 5 years to write it, between 59 and 64. It was published in 64.
And that was your first book published?
Catherine Carmier, yes. Yeah. Uh-huh. And it was somewhat like the first thing I tried to write 10 years earlier, about a young man from California who goes back to the South, goes back to Louisiana, and to visit his aunt. But he's found that everything has changed. His whole life has changed. He's so different from everybody around him. And he falls in love with a beautiful girl, and, it's a tragic story. So that's what I wrote.
Your books all take place in Louisiana, a place where you left when you were 15.
Mm-hmm.
Why do your novels take you back to the place you grew up?
Well, I think most writers write about the place that had the greatest impact on them, the impression on them as young people. Not only Ernie Gaines, but you'd find the same thing in a writer, say, like James Joyce, or many of your Russian writers, or any writers. They write about the old home place much more than they write about any other place.
Well, the Bayonne in your books is a coupé parish?
Well, Pointe-Coupée is the parish. Bayonne is the town within the parish. Bayonne would be the town seat. Bayonne is based something like the small town of New Roads, which is the parish seat of Pointe-Coupée Parish. And in my book, of course, I changed the names around. For example, Pointe-Coupée Parish is called St. Raphael Parish. And because my stepfather was named Raphael, his maternal name, his mother's name, was Bayonne. And so I gave the town Bayonne. But I use that throughout the book and throughout all of my books. I use my family names to name the parishes, the towns, the rivers, the roads, or whatever.
Does your family enjoy that? Do they look for their names in your books?
I don't think so.
Say, I'm a river in this book, and
no, I don't think they do that. I don't know if they even read them.
No, really?
I hope so. Well, we play cards more than we read books or talk about books. We like to play whist, so we do more of that than talk about discussing books. They're very proud of it, of course, you know, and they have them around the place, all over the place. They tell their friends about it, but I never ask them, what do they think of it?
Ernest Gaines' latest novel is called A Lesson Before Dying. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer has joined us to tell us about the news today. Linda, what stories will you be covering on All Things Considered?
Marty, we are leading with Bosnia, where the Serbian forces are putting tremendous pressure on the city of Srebrenica, and the United Nations is trying to figure out how to cope with refugees that are expected from that city. Ted Clark will be summing everything up for us. We will be talking to Wendy Kaufman in Los Angeles about who is on the jury in the LAPD trial. We'll have a report from Massachusetts, where there has been a week of unprecedented violence in public high schools in Massachusetts. And we will be remembering Wallace Stegner.
Thanks, Linda. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Roberto Colasso is an Italian scholar and director of a prestigious publishing house in Milan. He's written a new book called The Marriage of Cadmus and Harmony, which is his first book to be published in this country. Critic John Leonard has this review.
Who'd have imagined that an Italian literary critic, just for the joy of it, would rethink and retell the Greek myths from the point of view of the heroes, who were, of course, invariably the children of mortal beings and Olympian gods, up to and including the last time these mortals and these gods sat down to dinner together at the marriage of Cadmus and Harmony, after which there was so much grief and no way to write home about it that Cadmus gave us the alphabet, making possible so many libraries full of poems and history. Roberto Colasso is as lyrical as the Roman poet Ovid, whose Metamorphoses on the same subject caused him to be banished for life by the Emperor Augustus. He's a lot more comfortable than Sir James Fraser was in The Golden Bough about bisexuality. He's just as alert to dreadful intimations as was Robert Graves, whose White Goddess ransacked the same terrain in search of a worthy muse. By taking certain interpretive liberties with Homer, he is likely to offend admirers of Edith Hamilton and Gilbert Hyatt. And he chooses wholly to ignore recent historiography on Greek civilization. From Walter Burkert on the one hand, who suggests strong Near Eastern influences, to Martin Bernal on the other, whose Black Athena argues the case for Semitic and African roots. But Colasso is looking through his own telescope at constellations of the dreamy mind. The thing about the gods is that they cared, at least at the start, more about perfection than they did about power. They were the first aesthetes. All this fell apart at the dinner table. Guilt, you'll be interested to know, originates in eating, which is something the gods never did, preferring ambrosia, until men introduced the idea of animal sacrifice, probably because Prometheus was up to one of his tricks. Ever after, abduction and rape were not only what gods did to mortals, but also the principal form of East-West cultural exchange in the ancient world, with its Europas and Io's, bulls and cows, Medea and Argonauts, poor Helen, stolen first by Theseus and later on by Paris of Troy, Ariadne and Argos and Naxos, Persephone in the underworld, and so on. Dionysus got them drunk before he raped them, though his first love had been a boy. His phallus, we are told, was hallucinogenic, like a fungus. I'm not making any of this up. Nor, of course, was incest unknown to Zeus and his sister, Hera. We're reminded that the family values of the House of Atreus included incest, infanticide, parricide, matricide, cannibalism, and other gaudy dysfunctions. Helen was in trouble from the get-go, from an Asia Minor mother with a name like Nemesis. Sparta, choosing power over perfection, appears to have been the prototype for Nazi Germany and Stalinist Russia. And Cadmus? Well, his sister was Europa, now the queen of Crete, and his wife was Harmony, now an old snake. If another king from Egypt, Danaus, with his 50 bloodthirsty daughters, had brought to Greece the gift of water, Cadmus had something else in his saddlebags. With vowels and consonants yoked together in tiny signs, Cadmus gave to Greece nothing less than the etched model of a silence that speaks. To the gods, ever since, like Colasso in this skylark of a book, we've been talking back.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed The Marriage of Cadmus and Harmony by Roberto Colasso and translated by Tim Parks. Fresh Air's administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Research by Penny Nelson. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Michael Palin of the Monty Python troupe. His new film, American Friends, is based on the life of his great-grandfather, a middle-aged bachelor and an Oxford don, who gave up academia to marry a much younger woman. We also meet performance artist and stand-up comic Marga Gomez. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.